Welcome back to Radio Rothbard. I'm Ryan McMakin. I'm a senior editor at the Mises Institute. And this week, we're going to be talking a little bit about the myths and the lies that are being perpetuated all the time by the Washington establishment and its media friends. We heard, of course, all the time during Trump's days that fake news was a thing now, and Trump had a weird relationship with the truth, and he was a liar, and he wasn't concerned with accuracy like normal Washington politicians are. That, of course, was all total nonsense, although we're now supposed to believe that now that Trump is gone, we're all going to get back to the totally and absolutely truthful basis of public discussion that existed before Trump, and which will now surely exist again with Biden in control and with the usual Washington people running things. And let's look at what the truth really is. There's plenty of myths and lies that have always been going on there. And some of the ones that have been going on for decades, they're not going anywhere, especially in issues like foreign policy and government spending and how power is really used in Washington. And so here to discuss some of that with me is Tho Bishop, our associate editor here at the Mises Institute. Tho, how are you today?
I'm doing well.
Well, we're going to get together and just make it clear that there is no end to fake news. I am not really confident that it was any worse during Trump's days than it's going to be now or was back during the days of George W. Bush or Obama. Plenty of garbage being slung around then that wasn't remotely true. And we've brought a couple of our favorite ones to just discuss in not too much detail, but really just to highlight some of these conspiracies, myths, and lies that are alive and well in Washington today. So, Tho, why don't you kick us off?
This topic, I think, is good this week, considering all the attention that has been played to Marjorie Taylor Greene, the new congresswoman over in Georgia. And so you have not only the press doing press things, but you had Mitch McConnell out there saying that, oh, these loony lies are dangerous and a cancer to the GOP. And yet, you know, there's so much stuff that is just so baked into typical D.C. conversation that's ridiculous. And I think this is the low-hanging fruit. We'll start with that one. But it's the entire depiction of Russia, I think, in recent years. And I think that this is something that could have very dire consequences in the next few years. But, you know, again, it's humorous, right? Where, you know, I think that today on Thursday, the Democratic House is actually going to remove Marjorie Taylor Greene from all of her committees, which isn't usually done, right? Usually it's your party that removes you from your committees because, like, oh, well, she said, you know, embrace some crazy things, and oh, she accused Nancy Pelosi of treason, and this you know, calling for an assassination for Nancy Pelosi because, you know, the death penalty comes with treason. So 2 weeks ago, I think there was treason. You know, everyone was accusing Republican senators for treason. So it's just, you know, the whole thing I think is entertaining, but the Russia thing, I mean, literally the position of, you know, the Democratic Party for 4 years was that Trump was a literal paid operative of the Russian government. Even Kevin McCarthy, who was the Republican leader, was talking about this in D.C. circles in, like, 2015. And of course, before that, it all goes back to, you know, where tensions really kind of escalated with the issue with the Russian relations with Ukraine, which I know the Ron Paul Institute did great work on the time, highlighting just how much of this had nothing to do with Russian aggression in Crimea, right, which the history there is so interesting because, I mean, Crimea is ethnically Russian, a longstanding, you know, relationship with Russia itself that, you know, predates the Soviet Union and all those sort of things. You know, but we've made Russia the great boogeyman of, you know, the outside of perhaps the Middle East and increasing now China, you know, in order to keep, you know, this NATO alliance alive and try to maintain, keep the old gang back together from the Soviet Union. And the dangers of it, I think, going forward is that, you know, we've been in an economic war with Russia for years now because of, you know, the issue with Ukraine. That's one of the interesting things and one of the disappointing things of the Trump administration is that there was no real effort, you know, beyond any personal back and forth between Trump and Putin. You know, sanctions came. You know, I think Trump, you know, escalated everything on the economic side of things with Russia. And going forward, you're having this very interesting battle. It's, you have this protest going on now over opposition leaders and things like that, where they're really much, there's a lot of banging the drums within DC circles for getting serious about the need for regime change, in a country that is one of the most resistant against it's an imperfect term, but kind of the neoliberal the zeitgeist that has infected a lot of the West. And you had military officials just this week talking about, we have to be serious about the potential of using nukes against Russia should things come to it. So again, I think the idea of making Russia this continuing boogeyman when it's a country with a decreasing population, this is not one of the great threats of the world. Anything inconvenient that happens in politics, it's so easy to blame Russia. You have Jimmy Kimmel out there, he was blaming the Wall Street Bets people on Russia. Every good conspiracy theory needs a group that you can blame everything on, and for most of Washington, it is Russia. The fact that it was the mainstream view of the Democratic Party for 4 years, I think, makes this current conversation all the more humorous. Though, of course, the hypocrisy is certainly goes back as long as loony lies do in American politics.
Well, that was always an interesting thing about it, was at the same time that they were talking about how the election was stolen thing was such a outlandish conspiracy theory. The media for years had been pushing this whole Russia is running America's elections theory, and just without shame and acting as if this were just established fact. And they were helped along by the U.S. military establishment, which didn't like Trump and so was really always happy to imply that the Russians were doing this sort of thing. But it's really kind of a safe bet that anytime the intelligence community says something about Russia or says something that makes it seem the U.S. is under threat from one of these major foreign powers, it's like asking your barber if you need a haircut, right? Of course they're going to say that. And they have a terrible track record. There's an interesting book that really should be read more often. It's by some scholars named Milo Jones and Philippe Silberzon. It's called Constructing Cassandra. And it talks about the internal culture at the CIA and how the CIA, because the CIA is incapable really of processing information in a non-political fashion, misses most of the big stories. So it was the CIA who told us that the Soviet Union was only getting stronger throughout the 1980s and would soon overtake the U.S. in terms of economic power. And they were, of course, completely wrong. The CIA completely missed the brewing revolution in Iran in the late 70s. They didn't know what was going on with Cuba prior to the Bay of Pigs. They were completely wrong about that. They, of course, let 9/11 happen right under their noses. And nevertheless, we were all supposed to believe that these people in regards to Russiagate. And the media was happy to run with that. And yes, as you say, Russia has just been the convenient country to use. Why? Well, they're big enough to look scary, but they're too weak to be actually a threat in terms of global hegemony. You can't invade Russia, so you can't get rid of their regime, even if they are ridiculously talking about regime change. But at the same time, they're big, right there. They're not a threat like China might be in establishing real control over a part of Eurasia. And so it's there. It's easy to use. Whereas at least during the Cold War, the Soviet Union was a lot bigger and at least maybe would have been able to exert some real power, although Rothbard probably correctly claimed it was just a status quo power that wanted to maintain its power where it was and really was too weak to do much beyond that. That was probably more accurate, but it was more believable, at least under the Soviets, whereas now it's just obvious myth that the Russians are going to be taking over the U.S. anytime soon or presenting any serious geopolitical threat. But here we are, and I think we should expect to keep hearing plenty about that. So moving on to number two, here's a perennial favorite. This is the idea that Republicans are the fiscal conservatives and the responsible ones in Washington as far as spending goes. And we talked about this a little bit last time and just how obviously untrue this is. And I've done some more detailed analysis in terms of party control in Washington. And even if we really pull it out and we pay real attention to the details in terms of who controls Congress, who controls the White House, and really try to analyze, okay, is it divided government? Do the Republicans have total control? Do the Dems have total control? It was actually when the Dems had total control that you had the least amount of runaway spending, when they had both Congress and the presidency. In the middle was so-called gridlock, which we were supposed to believe would result in very little spending going on, and that's apparently not the case. And then the worst situation was when the Republicans were in total control. And you could see a little bit about how that happened. Obviously, George W. Bush didn't care anything about limiting spending. This is the guy who gave us Medicare Part D, massively increased spending. And what was the argument when he was running for re-election? Obviously, his whole Medicare Part D program was a scheme to get re-elected, right? And let's pay off the voters, shovel lots of cash to old people, and they'll vote for me. And it totally worked. But the line of argument among Republican hacks was, well, if you don't support the president on this, then a Democrat's going to win, and then where will you be? Apparently, we'd have less spending if the Democrats won. And on this issue, so we got George W. Bush massively increased spending by the most amount since the Great Society. And then we're supposed to hear about, well, once you get him back in office, then we'll really start to take control of the fiscal situation. We'll pay down the debt and so on. It's obviously complete and utter nonsense. And he ended up paving the way for massive increases in spending that Obama could then use without increasing spending on his own. So he really just handed a big gift to the Obama administration, much as Reagan and Bush handed gifts to Clinton in the 1990s, whereas Reagan had massively increased deficit spending and military spending overall. And then, of course, Bush didn't care about that and was happy to spend plenty of money. So it just seems the Republicans come in on this lie that they're going to control spending. They actually increase it quite a bit and then hand over this new status quo to the Democrats. And that's what happened between Bush and Obama. But then Trump's doing the exact same thing. I went and I looked in at just how much does spending increase under each of these administrations. In most cases, it's in the teens and 20s, going all the way back to Nixon. We can see in cases of Carter, Clinton, Nixon. Reagan was different. Reagan got up to around 20% increase during his terms. And of course, it matters whether you need to look at it on average, but we could look just at two-term presidents, and we would see that George W. Bush had the highest amount during this period, which was around 40% increase in spending during his tenure. And a lot of that, of course, was the freak out that occurred in late 2008 and early 2009 when Bush just started saying, well, stimulus spending to everybody, free money all around. And basically, Trump blows that all out of the water. 64% increase in spending just during Trump's one term. So this is just astounding levels of spending. And I was already warning back in 2019, look, Trump's already increasing the deficit to $1 trillion, which normally would never be seen when we weren't in the middle of some horrible depression, such as occurred back in 2008 when everybody hit the panic button. And so there was nonstop deficit spending then. But then the economy supposedly was doing really well in 2019. But Trump just opened the floodgates to just shovel money out the door. And then, of course, we saw what happened in 2020. So there's zero reason. I can't believe people are still saying this. But now that Biden's president, we're back to this myth again, where you're hearing people on Capitol Hill and Heritage Foundation and so on. Oh, you know, we got to worry about deficits. They're really big. We got to worry about spending. They don't care when there's a Republican in office. They didn't want to point out the nonsense of it. But now we're going through this sort of, we're miming this pretend situation where we care about deficits and fiscal spending now that the Democrats are back in control, and it's really quite nonsensical.
Right. I mean, it was, I think it was Senator Thune this week that talked about, again, within this whole brouhaha with some of the members, about, oh, you know, the Republican Party can either continue to be the party of small government and individual responsibility, or can embrace these conspiracy theories. And it's just, and regardless of the track record of the policy of the GOP in the first place, you know, when you allow the enemy to define what is allowable within your party, then you're not going to stand for anything in general, right? And I think that's one of the biggest things that have worked against the GOP. And I think that's one of the things that's really interesting about the modern era is that, you know, they're starting to get serious about the issues with you know, the corporate press, starting to get serious with all of these different, you know, recognizing that this respectability game, you know, that's one of the real interesting sort of inner party battles going on. But the people that are blind to it, and they think that, oh, you know, they still think that we live in an age where, you know, it's all you know, backslapping deals and you know, your personal relationships within, you know, this cocoon of power within D.C. in the first place that translates into policy wins. And it's just with how polarizing, how nationalized congressional politics has really become, where your power comes less from your support within your district, but from, you know, these national, being able to activate national activists behind your cause. I mean, this AOC, like, this is her particular strength here, right? Or Matt Gaetz. You know, you've seen freshman congressmen who typically would have no say at all in the legislative process, right, interject themselves into and have a larger than average shadow. They don't always get the wins, but they get a shadow on this conversation because of the way that the actual, you know, organization of political will has kind of changed. You know, regardless of what the GOP tries to stand for, what any political party tries to stand for, as long as they keep falling into this trap of allowing again, you know, how the media defines certain members to really be the siren call of what they're doing, you know, there's no hope for any sort of gains or changes if, you know, for those Republicans that try to, you know, act, or, you know, perhaps, you know, genuinely are offended by some of the, you know, I'm not sure they're all complete phonies on this issue, but, you know, there's no chance of getting to what John Thune thinks the Republican Party should be if you're just going to let your enemy dictate the terms of engagement.
Well, our next topic is financial regulation. I suppose you could say this about all types of regulation, but there's this enduring myth that financial regulation helps the little guy. And tell us a little bit more about that.
That's the problem with this thing. So there's so much, you know, so many normalized assumptions in D.C. are just so out of whack with reality that, you know, this could be a you know, Joe Rogan-length podcast if we wanted to. But I think particularly with, you know, this came up big last week with the Wall Street Bet stuff. Is, you know, we're sold that, oh, well, we need the SEC, we need all these regulatory agencies because, you know, they try to project it as like, oh, well, you know, they're the ones, they're the cops on the beat that protect average Joes from, you know, the sinister plots of these Wall Street fat cats. And it's no, I mean, the consolidation, the centralization of financial regulation has always been explicitly to preserve the institutional powers of these banks. Yeah, that's, you know, Rothbard was making this argument, you know, in terms of the case for the Fed originally in the 1913, and you know, the consequences there arising from the financial crisis and, you know, earlier in the 20th century. But the SEC is a particular villain in my book because, I mean, I always think it's amusing because if you look back, you know, one of the big financial scandals, one of the most obvious and kind of the most cartoonish financial scandal, you know, is like the Bernie Madoff situation, you know, years ago. And I can, and here's a case where, like, you had multiple whistleblowers go to the SEC and saying, hey, look, like, this guy, like, this is obviously like a Ponzi scheme. And like, and these are like small fish. I mean, like, there are people who are just kind of looking at, like, hey, like, this guy's promising this sort of returns consistently. Like, this isn't kosher. And the SEC did nothing. Did nothing. And like, Bernie Madoff wasn't taken down until, for you had some, I think it was someone kind of getting in the story, and then he ended up confessing to his sons that, I think it was kind of a way of trying to bail them out. You know, they kind of sold Bernie Madoff in exchange for defending the sons. But like in the SEC, and of course the beauty of it is that they were rewarded for this, you know, years of incompetency with a larger budget, because that's typically the way things happen in D.C. But it's not just that though. I mean, it's the you know, you have the state authorized, state approved credit rating agencies. I mean, you have the big three, and of course, it's precisely because they have this unique relationship with government that they're awful at their jobs. You know, you had I can't remember the name off the top of my head, but you had there's these other credit rating agencies out there that don't have quite that same state privilege, and they're out there calling outing the dangers that existed with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, you know, the dangers that existed with some of these mortgage, various financial products out there in which institutions were over-leveraged on it. And they were completely shut out of the equation because they don't have that government stamp. John Adelson's book on the cause of the financial crisis and its free market cure, I think that's the title. It goes into great detail about, you know, the consequence of Sarbanes-Oxley, which had massive changes in terms of, in particular, corporate auditing and accounting standards as a result from the Enron stuff. The way that, you know, these sort of things actually made it more difficult and helped fuel the larger financial instability with the subprime bubble because of the way that it forced banks to consider mortgages on their books. I mean, this entire labyrinth of financial regulation effectively serves to codify and protect large-scale institutional investors at the expense of small ones. And again, that's one of the things I never quite understood the end game for the Wall Street Bets crowd, but at the very least, the illustration made so explicitly at the way this system effectively serves that purpose, I thought was very useful. Hopefully that was a red pill moment of sorts for anybody out there still clinging to the idea that regulators are here to serve us. And that's something that I think could perhaps develop into something interesting down the line, particularly as, you know, they're moving from GameStop and AMC to, what was the thing now, Dogecoin and Bitcoin. You know, that I think is a far more interesting stick-it to a again, because of course, then it will be, now we have to try to criminalize Bitcoin to protect American consumers because, Bitcoin is used for drug crimes and terrorism and Trump supporters. We can't allow that. So again, as this one new one narrative creates another in this race to always protecting the little guy.
Well, this is some information we've seen just in the data following Dodd-Frank, and really what's been happening to a lot of small and community banks is a lot of them have been under a lot more pressure as the feds have regulated banking more and more. And what it's meant has been a shift in power and resources to huge banks like JP Morgan Chase, rather than helping out those smaller community banks that you see, right, that are just within a single state or maybe even within a part of a single state. And it's really, really made it more difficult for a lot of these smaller operations to survive, partly because of the regulation itself and partly because of what the Fed is doing in terms of forcing down interest rates, which makes it harder for these smaller banks that have fewer resources to survive. And so it's always just really a safe bet that if Washington has got some big plans for something, it's going to be what happened during the New Deal. It's going to be, we get all of these big Washington elite types in the room, and then we get just the people from the major organizations in the room. And just as FDR really based so much of his policy on partnerships with the giant corporations, this is mostly now what happens in terms of financial regulation and most other types of regulation, is it's at such a big national level, the only people who get represented are the big organizations. And so small business people, medium-sized groups, they're just left out in the cold most of the time. And so regulation more and more is designed to help the big guys. And it really does produce a situation where it raises again and again the barriers to entry into the marketplace. It reduces competition in the overall marketplace, driving up prices for regular people, making it harder for regular people to find employment outside of this small handful of mega corporations. And what you've got left in the private sector are just these real tiny organizations that have very low barriers to entry. And these are some of the, right, you can have local bookkeepers and some local concierge services, and of course, some local restaurants and that sort of thing. Of course, now they're all under siege thanks to COVID shutdowns and that sort of thing. But the whole system now is really tightening the noose on small businesses. And I think financial regulation is a big part of this, and also monetary policy, which plays into it. So it's really becoming harder and harder for the small guys. And this idea that the feds are really concerned about protecting ordinary folks from big, huge financial corporations is sheer nonsense. Almost everything that happens in Washington favors these guys, and not to mention monetary policy, which of course is geared all toward helping out Wall Street and bailing them out and propping them up, whereas the rest of the country, Main Street, has to fend for itself. So the whole thing is totally off kilter. And so anytime Washington says something about how they're gonna help the little guy, you can just completely ignore them.
One point on that, when I was with the Financial Services Committee, Dodd-Frank was a lot of what we did. So I learned a lot of things that it has made me very angry. But like, I mean, one of the humorous things is that, you know, like, this was sold as Wall Street reform. Like, and I mean, the size of Wall Street banks since Dodd-Frank passed is substantially larger than it was before. And I mean, I know I see it here very vividly, but like the number of small banks, at Main Street banks, have pretty much disappeared. I mean, now we've got a lot of credit unions because credit unions get their own kind of, they're treated legally differently, which is its own kind of interesting thing. It was always fun seeing the lobbyists like fight each other between community bank lobbyists and credit rating agent or credit union lobbyists. But now like you've seen this gradual consolidation of like, small banks became regional banks. Regional banks are consolidating. There's like SunTrust and another one, maybe BB&T was consolidating. And so, I mean, all of this has just led directly to creating, more and more Wall Street control of the financial industry. And it's just like, it just drives me crazy.
Well, the last topic is foreign policy. Now, we had talked a little bit about just the Saddam Hussein perpetrated 9/11 issue. And then we realized, everything in foreign policy is of questionable value in terms of veracity and truth. But let's just start off talking about the Saddam thing. Right now, if you're an old timer like me, you remember that in the wake of 2001, the Bush administration was strongly hinting that Saddam Hussein was somehow involved in 9/11. Now, of course, politically, this made a lot of sense, right? Americans were extremely angry over 9/11, fearful. So the Bush family, which never really liked Saddam Hussein, largely because of the Bush family's close personal ties to the Saudi regime, the bloodthirsty, far worse than Saddam Hussein Saudi regime, didn't want to get Saddam out of there. So let's just say he caused 9/11. And a huge number of Americans believed this. Even years later, at least a third of Americans still thought that was the truth. And Bush had gone to the CIA and said, hey, find me the data that shows Saddam did this. It was so blatantly untrue that even the CIA balked on this and had trouble handing over themselves to putting out supporting data showing that Saddam was, in fact, behind 9/11. But nevertheless, that kind of seamlessly moved into the weapons of mass destruction thing, which the Iraqi regime then put out this long, long report about how we don't have weapons of mass destruction, which turned out to be 100% true. And what the Bush administration was saying was completely untrue. And there were no weapons of mass destruction, although conservatives for years afterward would get excited every time there was like a cache of machine guns found under the ground somewhere in some old abandoned hideout. And look, we found some weapons of mass destruction. This was a myth that just would not go away. Nobody talks about it anymore. But we can now see this sort of thing really morphing into other aspects of this, right? That we could talk about how Saddam Hussein was on the same side of Al-Qaeda, even though this was completely untrue. Saddam Hussein's regime was the secularist Ba'athist regime, something akin to what is the regime in Syria. And nevertheless, the fact that there was no reason for Saddam to be allied with these groups like Al-Qaeda was completely ignored. We just say, because what do Americans know about any of that stuff? We can say whatever we want in foreign policy. And there's the same sort of thing in Syria then, where, hey, look, these rebel groups, they're the good guys. The Syrian regime is terrible. That was true, right? The Syrian regime perpetrated many crimes because it's a brutal dictatorship like most regimes in that area, and no more brutal than the Saudi regime, with which we are close allies. By we, of course, I mean the U.S. regime, not normal people. And but we'll create this idea that these rebels are the good guys here. And so you got pictures of John McCain smiling, taking pictures with these people who are basically terrorists. And so we were supporting the terrorists then in Syria because, well, for whatever reason, we decided we needed to get rid of Assad. And so people believed that. And then you had a bunch of Americans believing that Gaddafi was some sort of threat to America in Libya, a guy with basically no resources, thoroughly isolated. But The Europeans wanted to reassert their control in Libya, so this guy's the next Hitler. And that, of course, continued a long tradition going back beyond Saddam Hussein into the past, but really was turned up a notch during the 1990s when we would hear about how Slobodan Milosevic in Serbia was the next Hitler, and look at all these horrible things he does. He's got camps and so on. So we got to do that. We got to bomb Serbia. We need a new war there. And it just goes on and on and on. And it really is about, to use the phrase, manufacturing consent. And this is a phrase that's been around for a while and is really used to apply to this idea that the media and the regime get together and they just throw out hints or just outright falsehoods about this is what's going on in all these foreign countries and horrible things are happening. So we have to intervene in order to restore the restore a somewhat more humanitarian situation. And so everybody get on board with the war. Now, of course, Americans know almost nothing about it. They pay no attention to these foreign countries most of the time. And so they actually believe the regime when it comes and says, oh, look, the CIA said this is going on, or, oh, look, the State Department says we need a war, and then we just roll with it. And it just happens again and again and again. And yet we're being lectured by Washington and the media about the need to fact check everything. You can imagine if there was any actual fact checking going on in the media or Washington, the U.S. wouldn't have participated in any of these wars in recent decades. But that's what did happen. And we just really need to just come to the full realization that it's all just made up stuff. And these regimes aren't threats to Americans, and that they're there to really increase the power of the regime. And average people have basically no dog in this fight whatsoever. But they get convinced that they do because they eat up all of this, for lack of a better term, fake news from the media and from Washington types.
One of the examples building on that was the whole axis of evil in the first place, where you had a lumping in of Iran and Iraq, which made no sense at all. Like, I mean, that's something, as nutty as a Jewish space laser causing the California wildfires. I mean, like, this is it's again, and we're sold to this with a straight face, and there's no consequence to it either, right? I mean, David Frum, who was the speechwriter for the Axis of Evil speech, is still celebrated by places like The Atlantic as being a serious person. The consequence of that is particularly sinister and evil when you consider the fact that again, regardless of your opinion about the reaction to 9/11. Iran was like literally an ally in Afghanistan in the immediate aftermath. Like, I mean, they had all these demonstrations in Iran, in memory of the victims of 9/11. And when you remember, like, in the early days of the Afghanistan war, a big deal was made about, like, oh, we've got this kind of ready-made group of allies, the Northern Alliance. All these anti-Taliban forces. This gives us such a great advantage going in here, and we're going to be welcomed as liberators and all the typical narrative there, and yet like the people that were responsible for connecting the U.S. kind of building that relationship between the U.S. military and the Northern Alliance was Iran, and you had this entire thing was trying to Iran saw an opportunity, the government saw the opportunity, where like you had moderate forces saying like, okay, well, here's an opportunity to thaw relations after everything that happened after the Iranian Revolution. Here was the opportunity to come in. They were making progress. Now, I mean, Iran's issues with Israel didn't change overnight, right? Iran's issues with other countries didn't change overnight. But Iran was trying to make a concerted effort to be helpful in this war on terror thing. I mean, they even, I think, organized like a Middle Eastern conference in support of this. And then all of that gets pulled from out from under them with the Axis of Evil speech. Like the Bush administration effectively burned all the people in the Iranian government that were trying to create peaceful, diplomatic, and productive ties with the U.S. And that's exactly what So the response to that from the Ayatollah was to now we're going to celebrate and we're going to push in. So there is no potential for Western outreach. We then need to work on doubling down on appealing to our strong religious constituents, you know, we're going to create a kind of an internal populist nationalist figure. Mahmoud Ahmadinejad was kind of plucked out from obscurity and kind of made into this national figure because he kind of checked a lot of boxes. And it's like that was a whole thing in response to the Bush administration's lumping in two historic enemies into this conspiracy. And the consequence of that, we're still feeling this today. I mean, think of the number of Iranians that have died. And the frustrating thing about Iran is that like so many of like that the middle class and the merchant class and you know the ones that were Western friendly during the revolution, the very sort of people that would otherwise have a lot more culturally in common with the U.S. than a lot of other people in the region. I mean, they're the ones that have been completely devastated 20 years later because of again this David from this miserable little horrible human being casually doing this to try to whip up the bloodlust here in the U.S. And again, there's no consequence to this sort of depravity. And it is that's one of the things that you get an age of conspiracy theories when people lose faith in the institutions. And in the U.S., the lack of faith in institutions is very well deserved. One of the things that just really makes my blood boil.
That's just four issues. And we could go on like this for hours. Of course, we put together a much longer list than this, but we better cut it off here in terms of the ongoing lies and cherished myths that continue in Washington day after day. So I think the overall message is don't worry, fake news isn't over. It's just now we're going to be told it's all back to normal, that we've achieved a situation of stability and now we can trust our institutions again. This is completely untrue, but just get used to it. Finally, if we can just agree that we're all being lied to, then we can just move on. Live like you're a Eastern European living under the Soviets or a Russian, right? There's real reality, and then there's the fake reality that the regime tells you. So just embrace that. Embrace that there's a dual reality, and... that will set you free, I think, where you just completely don't even get mad about anymore that what you're being told has nothing to do with what's actually going on in the world. And you'll probably feel better. So thank you for joining us this time on Radio Rothbard. We'll be back again next week. I have no idea what will be going on then. Maybe we'll cover in a little bit more detail issue of the GameStop situation. Maybe once the dust settles a little bit, we can get a better handle on it. But we'll see. But until we're back again, have a wonderful week.